on this edition of The Self-Publishing Show.
It was a very untraditional approach to ghostwriting for me because I'm used to being the interviewer. But with John, I wasn't allowed to do that. I had to literally go on the run with him. I had to travel Europe with him. Allegedly, we were on the run from the cartel across America. And that was a weird time.
Publishing is changing. No more gatekeepers. No more barriers. No one standing between you and your readers. Do you want to make a living from your writing? Join indie bestseller Mark Dawson and first-time author James Blatch as they shine a light on the secrets of self-publishing success. This is The Self-Publishing Show. There's never been a better time to be a writer.
Hello and welcome to The Self-Publishing Show with me, James Blatch, and welcome back, Mark Dawson.
Oh, hello.
You had a sabbatical.
Yeah, not one I was kind of intending to take, but it's been a difficult few weeks with illness and other things going on. So, yes, well done for holding the fort.
That's right. I'm back. Well, you know, you have lots of support and friends here in the community, and I know we all go through these life events, so it's better to do it together. Okay, let us press on. We've got a few things to talk about before we have our interview, a very interesting interview today about somebody who's had an extraordinary experience recently writing a non-fiction book and is talking mainly about ghostwriting, about that work when you work alongside somebody else to produce a work, and very often your name's not on it. We've talked about it a little bit before, but he's in a very good position at the moment. He's a very sought-after ghostwriter. And you'll find out why coming up. We noticed this week, Mark, that there was a survey produced by I can't remember who actually produced it.
The ALCS. So it's the body in the UK responsible for kind of providing authors with remuneration when their copyrights are used. So it's libraries and things like that.
Okay, and they found that authors are earning less than ever before. When you look at the sort of average or the what they call the median, one type of average earnings, it was basically the minimum wage or even less than the minimum wage.
Way less.
Yeah.
Way less. So it's a survey. It's a regular survey. They've done it several times before. It's done in conjunction with the Society of Authors. Ally were involved, although I don't know quite how much. I think there were some indies took part, but mostly not. They kind of make a big play about how it's 60,000 authors were surveyed, only 2,500 responded. So that needs to be borne in mind. But I think the message is quite a valuable one and worth just us having a quick chat about. It was that the last time they did the survey 2 or 3 years ago, the median was about 11,500 to 12,000. It's now 7,000. So that's kind of way, way below the national average.
UK pounds, which, by the way, is about the same as UK dollars at the moment, not much different.
UK dollars.
US dollars.
Something happened I don't know about.
No, not yet.
So 7,000, about $10,000-ish in that kind of area. And you can't live off that anywhere. It doesn't mean London or anywhere else in the UK. It's impossible. And that's basically an electricity bill at the moment. It's not great. So we had lots of commentary on Twitter from people understandably bemoaning the fact that creators couldn't create if they were paid that way. And so I read the report. It's quite a long report. It is worth reading. And if we get around to it, we should put a link to it in the show notes. But it is quite bleak, and it doesn't. And it, you know, obviously the newspapers the next day were full of sky is falling headlines about how authors can't write like that, which is true. But what it didn't really pay attention to in any kind of substantial way was what's possible as indies. So it's very much focused on the trad industry and agents and publishers and all of that kind of.
It was all about advances and stuff, wasn't it?
Yeah, advances were covered, but generally the income that you can make, but it didn't cover what we can make. So I did a very, very unscientific poll in the SPF community, which had one question: did you make more or less than £7,000 last year? We had about 500 responses to that, and over half, I think 52% or 53%, made more than 7,000, which, and obviously of that number, some made much more than 7,000. Some would have made 7,000 in a couple of days. Obviously that's kind of at the top end, but many more made more than 7,000 than seemed to be the case in the survey. So I posted a kind of a thread on Twitter that I don't normally do, but I thought I'd just kind of, you know, at least flag that. And I got a couple of likes from some of the involved parties, the Society of Authors and things like that. But it's all, you know, it's all kind of well and good. But authors still don't know what's possible. It's ridiculous. Yeah. There are many authors for whom traditional publishing will be the way to go, no question. And, you know, I'm still traditionally published with my books getting into stores. Might mention that perhaps in a minute because there's been some changes there. But anyway, so there's that. But of these authors, I'm reading in the comments I'm seeing on Twitter from some of the people who are responding to the survey being posted. We're like, you know, I'm thinking about giving up. I've got a manuscript, like it's not selling. My rights have reverted. What was the point? I can't do anything with them. And just kind of thinking,
what?
It's easy to say what rock have they been living under, but I suppose also there's, as someone pointed out to me the other day, it's very easy for us to think that, but we were in our own little echo chamber where we know everything about indie publishing, and you know, we know how to do it. We know what the possibilities are, but most authors and most people still don't know. No. You know, they don't know, or if they do know, they think, I can't possibly do this. Too difficult. I'm not technical. All of those kinds of things we see all the time for people who are finding reasons not to to get their books out there. So it's, you know, I suppose what I take away from it is, number one, traditionally published, being traditionally published is definitely not a guarantee of riches and fame and fortune. It's never been less likely to deliver that. And number two, most people don't know what the alternatives are.
Yeah.
Which, you know, even as, you know, I've been doing this for 10 years now. And I think I spoke to Darren Hardy the other day, and I think KDP is 15 years. So, you know, this is not a new thing. It's been going for ages and people still don't know.
No, it's amazing how quickly bands appropriated platforms like Spotify and Napster, and how quickly fans realized that was what was happening and the world changed over in terms of indie music, and how slowly that's happening in publishing. Whereas you've got this hardcore of authors, which may be 500,000 strong, something like that, who are indies and have adopted it and are very passionate about it. But outside of that, which is millions of people around the world involved in publishing, is a slow take up, and the public arm's length from that. So it is odd. But I think it's always heartening for people listening to this podcast to know that you're in a smaller group than you think you are, of people who are aware of indie and the levers to pull to make that career happen. I also think that the survey itself was a bit flawed because it doesn't really take into account the changing nature of publishing. I mean, you've got, you know, what is an author is a good question to start with here. I think in the traditional sense, somebody who's been offered a deal, I suppose, at that point onwards has a deal and has income. And in the old days, that was a moment to quit your job as a solicitor or journalist or whatever you were doing and live off your income as an author. That's simply not possible anymore. The advances aren't there. The income from traditional publishing is nothing like what it used to be. And so I suppose they replicate a little bit more like what we're like, which is someone in my position has a full-time job, effectively, is writing on the side and building up an income. At what point, so my median income at the moment is going to be on the lower scale of that, or actually might be above 7,000, lower scale of that. And there'll be people who haven't published yet. Many thousands of them listen to this podcast probably haven't published yet. And a few hundred who are making seven figures, and a lot of people in between. And that's almost impossible to do a median income, I think. It doesn't take account of the nebulous, is that the right word, nature of how publishing operates now. It's a survey designed for 20 years ago.
I think it's possible to do it. I mean, if 1,000 people give you all their income, you can find what the median is. It's simple maths. But what this doesn't do is, well, number one, they only had 2,500 people responding. So that's a very small sample size. And of that, as you say, there were some indies who responded. I think 270, I think I read, or maybe 500 of those were indies, but that's a drop in the ocean. It doesn't, you know, I didn't respond to it. I didn't know about it.
No, I didn't know about it.
There aren't enough people responding to actually do that properly. I mean, make kind of thinking out loud here. We should commission a survey and do it for the show next year.
Well, yeah, I think I know. There's another thing. I'm thinking about how that survey might work. There's another thing to consider, which is when you're traditionally published, your income is profit. But when you're indie published, your income is just your revenue side of a business, and you've got expenses going out as well. So I'm interested to know, you know, somebody who in my position who has an income of $10,000 a year, but I spend $5,500 on ads. So my profit, if you want to do a like for like with a traditional publisher, a traditional author, I think I do wonder if the per book thing is a better measure. If you say how much do you make per book, so your profit if you're indie or income if you're traditional divided by the number of published books, that for me is an interesting figure, because that takes account of somebody who's an indie but hasn't got going yet, really has like one or two books, or you know, takes account of somebody who's got 30 books. Maybe that's what we should do.
I don't know. We'll think about that, but we should think about getting someone professional who knows about surveys more than we do.
We need to get Nielsen guy on, don't we? We were going to get him on a while back. I mean, this is somebody to talk to about this. They do a lot.
Not surveys. That's not. We need a specialist. We need Gallup or someone. I don't know. Gallup's still around? Probably not. But
Sock. What are they called?
Yeah, be quite interesting. You know, I'm kind of thinking about. I may do a session at next year's SPS show, and that would be quite a good one, wouldn't it? Kind of compare and contrast between the ALCS survey on the one hand and a kind of an indie survey. I think that'd be quite a good one to, you know, people should be interested. You should, you know, would we get newspapers that you're kind of posting headlines that authors can't turn their heating on because they don't make any money?
Yes.
Would they say, you know, authors, indie authors, have heating on all the time.
Yes. Indie authors wandering around the house in just a towel because it's so warm in the house. We could get together with 20 books and reads the other organizations and commission we need to start that now though, because there'll be a lot of lead-up work to that. I'm keen on that. Let's do it. I'm sure everyone else will say yes to that. So
and
I'll tell you what we'll do, we'll include trad authors in that as well.
Absolutely,
all authors. So it takes over that survey rather than does the indie version of it.
Yeah.
Okay. Sounds good. Anyway, you can comment below if you have anything to say on this subject, or preferably in our Facebook group. We can have a discussion on it. Good. Okay. I think we are going to just quickly mention our challenge. So Facebook ads, which are absolutely a driver for my growing income, 100%. I am getting more and more into Amazon ads, and I am running them at the moment, actually, and knocking around the profitable bit, but I need a few more books, I think, for that to work properly. But Facebook ads are my bread and butter, both for me and for Fuse Books, our imprint. And we want to get you running Facebook ads, familiar with the platform, competent to a level where they are going to be working for you. So we're going to run a challenge. We're going to do this in January. It'll be over a few days, 5 to 7 days.
Seven days.
There'll be something to do every day. You'll get instructional videos and help and discussions in the Facebook group to do that. We'll do it all together. I just want to flag that up. So the only thing you need to do at the moment is be on our mailing list. If you're not already, selfpublishingformula.com, just enter through the front door there, or be in our Facebook group, preferably do both of those things. And if you just search for SPF Community on Facebook and join that group. I'm looking forward to that. We've got Christmas. We can have some downtime over Christmas, but then we can get going in January and get off to a flyer in January. Whatever anyone says, and we always have these rumors about the Apple iOS changes of mean it doesn't work anymore. But Facebook ads not only drive profit for me, drive profit for our Fuse authors, they've actually got much better. I don't know what it is. In the last 2 or 3 months, I think I'm getting back down to 11, 12, 13 pence per click on my books, which I hadn't seen for some time. I don't know whether it's the recession that bigger businesses pulled out of, it's cut its advertising budget. You can imagine in a big corporation, the first thing the crusty old CEO is going to do, it's a bit of a cliche, is say, well, what's this money on Facebook? We're not giving them any more money. And so they've slashed that budget, put it back into billboards and magazine. And that's to our advantage. That's just a guess, by the way.
Yeah, maybe. It's definitely a not bad time. Also, yeah, kind of pre-Christmas, not quite into Christmas yet. Yeah, no, it's I still run plenty of Facebook ads. I mean, what we'll be doing in the challenges is list building. So we'll be finding new readers, which is, you know, very, very important. Yeah, I think it'll be fun. We should join the list, and we'll do it, I think, through a Facebook group that we'll start to promote quite soon, where people can join that, and we'll have videos and conversations and things that will help you to start running those ads.
Yeah, good. I'm going to hopefully have my novella, which I'm very busy revising, to get off to the copy editor this week, next week probably. So that will be my lead magnets. It's good timing for me, actually, Mark.
Yeah, very good. Very good.
Okay, should we have our interview?
Why not? Yes.
So it's Alex Foster. Alex, very recently, interviewed a very well-known person. I'll let him, well-known and notorious for all sorts of reasons, and did his autobiography, came within inches of losing his life during the process, but understands more than anybody, I think, that process of turning someone's life or the story of a corporation or whatever it is into an actual readable story, which is the trick of nonfiction and autobiography, and how to be a ghostwriter, how to compile that information, the process to go through to make that work for you. His name, as I say, is Alex Foster. It's a very interesting interview. He's written a very interesting book to go along with it. And Mark and I will be back for a quick chat at the end.
This is The Self-Publishing Show. There's never been a better time to be a writer.
So Alex Cody Foster, welcome to The Self-Publishing Show. Great to have you here. We're going to be talking about ghostwriting. I know you do a bit of non-fiction writing, helping authors as well. And you spent a rather incredible period with a man doing his autobiography. It turned into a bit of an adventure. So we've got a lot to cover. Well, why don't you start by telling us a bit about yourself, Alex?
Sure, absolutely. I've always been a writer. I've always been a storyteller. When I was 8 years old, my dad let me watch the film From Hell, starring Johnny Depp. It was about Jack the Ripper. And so I was 8 years old and I was watching this crazy horror movie. And it inspired me so much that I just stole my dad's yellow legal pad and I wrote a 33 page single line story about who I thought Jack the Ripper was. Wow. And that sort of catapulted me into, you know, the world of storytelling. And I was a very avid reader ever since I was a kid. In high school, I was kind of a bad kid, actually, and I got in trouble and I was almost expelled. But my guidance counselor argued on my behalf because I had, you know, spoken to him for hours and hours about literature. And he said, he's a bright kid. Let's give him another chance. But as part of that deal, he gave me a write-up, a piece of paper he printed out. It was the Times top 100 books of the 20th century. He said, Alex, you have to read all these books by the end of your stay here at the Academy. So I had 4 years to read those 100 books. I read them all.
Wow.
And then I just spent, you know, I was 18 and I hitchhiked across the country. I became homeless in Los Angeles. I had a life-changing experience there that kind of broke me down, broke my mind. And I spent the next couple of years just sort of traveling the world as a vagabond, trying to get my mind back, trying to get my identity back. And it happened during a 4-month journey by sea to the Inside Passage, along the Inside Passage to Alaska. You know, I had sort of an epiphany. For the first time in years, I became a person again. I had an identity. And that day that I got it back, it was in Seattle after 4 months. And that's the day I decided to become a writer. And quite quickly, I mean, I was 21 years old. And within a year, I had secured my first ghostwriting client by accident, who turned out to be kind of a sociopath. It was a bad intro into ghostwriting, but I fell in love with it. And I just continued to optimize it in every way possible. And I took that model that my guidance counselor had given me, those top 100 books, and I applied it to ghostwriting. So I read, you know, probably 50 or so of the best-selling books of the 21st century to get an idea of what sells and why. And so I've used that model for all of my books and all of my writing. I managed to get I got 8 number one Amazon bestsellers using that model for a client. And, Yeah, that's how it, that's great. The background. That's how it started.
What was your favorite novel out of the top novels of the 20th century?
It's going to sound cliche, but it was The Great Gatsby.
Yeah.
I just thought that was such a classic, beautiful book. You know, just a classic story. Yeah. I loved Mice and Men, pretty much anything by Steinbeck. I'm crazy about it.
Any British novelist got in there? It was a Times list, wasn't it? Or was it New York Times?
Oh, Anthony Burgess. You know, I read A Clockwork Orange. That one was incredible.
I was surprised reading that because the film's quite full on. Then you read the book and it goes a lot further than the film does. It's a quite disturbing novel, isn't it?
It is. And it's weird. It took me months just to sort of get past the 8-page mark because of the slang that he writes writes in. So, but once I did, it was incredible. Such a visceral experience.
Yeah. Well, that sounds like an interesting start to adulthood, put it that way. And you've obviously had some experiences. The ghostwriting for a sociopath, is that the John McAfee book?
No, I've worked with a few sociopaths.
Okay, he's just another one.
He's just the last one. Yeah, the most recent.
Because that's quite prominent. I mean, John McAfee, people only really know the name McAfee, and it is the same person from the antivirus software. But you somehow ended up writing his autobiography, and he did not turn out to be a straightforward character.
No, he did not. I mean, I took the project on with full knowledge that maybe he was a dark guy. You know, maybe he had done terrible things. But I wanted to prove that he hadn't done those things, or I at least wanted to know whether he did or not, because I've always been a black sheep. And when I saw what was happening to John in the media, I thought, man, he reminds me of myself. I want to get to the bottom of the story. And when I did, it was a very harrowing journey and experience. And I realized that actually he was a dark guy. He had done terrible things, some things that aren't covered in the Netflix documentary or the Showtime documentary, and some things the public doesn't even know about. You know, I discovered during my time with him, and it was enough to end our relationship. You know, after 6.5-7 months, I terminated our agreement, even though we had a pretty awesome agent on board and out of New York. And he said that we could easily get, you know, 6 figures, possibly even low 7 for the book. But I didn't want to compromise my integrity by doing that. I couldn't do that.
Because you felt the book would somehow sanitize what was a bad character?
Absolutely. You know, it was a very untraditional approach to ghostwriting for me because I'm used to being the interviewer. I set up the interviews, we're in a quiet place and there are no disruptions. But with John, I wasn't allowed to do that. I had to literally go on the run with him. I had to travel Europe with him. I had to go to bars and drink copious amounts of alcohol with him and just have a recorder ready. And he would talk about anything, you know, the sex lives of, you know, the samurai or his librarian phase when he only would sleep with librarians for years. And the time that he, you know, about his daughter or something, just, it was always so random and all over the place. Right. It was my job to capture it. But I realized at some point he was trying to paint himself as this sort of heroic figure, as this, you know, counterculture sort of icon, a guy who speaks truth to power and who's against corruption and so on. But it was just so much of it was fabricated, you know.
Did you ever feel scared for your own security with him?
Scared? I mean, technically, allegedly, we were on the run from the cartel across America, and he told me some really crazy things about why that came to be. That was a weird time. I wasn't scared. I was more so excited. But we got sort of kidnapped in Barcelona last time I saw him. And that was a pretty weird experience. I was very uncomfortable, for sure, because they wouldn't let me go.
So there is a McAfee autobiography out there. So how did that end up?
There is, yes. So this fellow, Mark Eglinton, a really wonderful guy, he got in touch with John after John and I severed our ties together. And he... I haven't read the book, but I guess he interviewed John from, you know, Scotland where he lives, and he put together sort of a biography of, you know, John's life, of John's timeline. Not really sure what's in that, because at that point, the interesting thing with John is that when we were working together, he wasn't on the run from the SEC. He wasn't in their purview, you know, so he told me crazy things that would probably get him imprisoned. So I think, I don't know because I haven't read Mark's book, but maybe he gave Mark the sanitized version because he was on the run. He didn't want to say things that would get him into further trouble. But again, I'm not sure.
Yeah. But you have, I think it's, you have written your account of what happened, and that, I think you published that recently, right?
Yeah. Yeah. A week and a half ago. And I think what's really cool about Mark's book and my book is that Mark was writing the biography of John, right? But the way that my book is written, it's not a biography of John. It's sort of a gonzo journalism take of being with a madman. So the things I saw, the things I heard, the things I experienced, more so than John's like history. I tell everybody it's not a biography. It's more of a story.
Yeah. Well, that's called The Man Who Hacked the World, A Ghostwriter's Descent into Madness with John McAfee. And that's available at the moment, as you say, a week and a half ago. But that's one aspect of ghostwriting, which people mostly understand, that David Beckham doesn't sit down at a typewriter, whatever, these days and write his own books. So someone writes biographies very often for the principal character. But you ghostwrite fiction as well.
I used to. I did everything, really. It's fiction, nonfiction, self-help, historical fiction, business, entrepreneurship, whatever. Back in the day, my colleague, Kathy Pelletier, who's been like a mentor to me, she called me a writing whore, basically.
Right.
Because I would take on anything because I was so interested in so many different topics. I didn't want to get pigeonholed into any one genre. So yeah, I worked on fiction, but slowly phasing that part out.
Okay, so you're not doing that so much anymore. And I often wonder with ghostwriting, we had Cara Thorburn, who ghostwrites romance fiction at the moment. And I often wonder what the attraction is of doing that when you could just be writing it and putting your own name on it.
That's an excellent question. And that's what a very prominent novelist asked me way back. And he's the fellow that I got the bestsellers for eventually. I said, well, it doesn't really pay. It doesn't really pay to just be a writer these days. And they say, don't quit your day job. And it's accurate for writing. You know, oftentimes, I mean, the top 1 or 2% of writers really are able to write full time and earn income. But with ghostwriting, I probably earn 5 or 7 times more than I would make as a traditional author, you know, because unlike the crapshoot of traditional publishing, if you're a ghostwriter, you get paid to write. That's a job.
Yeah.
That's a gig.
By the way, that was Cara's answer as well. She said, because it pays really well. And I don't know how long she's going to carry on doing it, but she does do it. So moving on to where you are today, obviously you've written this book about your experience with John McAfee, but what is your day-to-day? What's your intention now? You're going to stick with ghostwriting for other people?
You know, that's been a strange transition for me because I've been, as you know, in the shadows for like the last 8 or 9 years. I've been a ghost, and I had this book come out with my own name for the first time ever. And I thought, you know, that was a lot of fun. I kind of want to keep doing that. And I got on this podcast, you know, Writers Inc. And JD Barker, who has been James Patterson's co-author, he was impressed. He was so impressed with the interview. He said, hey, you mentioned you have some fiction projects under your belt, like you've never published. Can I check them out? So I sent him some, and he really liked them. And now we're working on a series together. So I think I'm going to slowly phase out of ghostwriting. I have a online course called Ghostwriting University, and a lot of people are signing up to that. I'm getting, you know, that's a fun project for me because I can teach people what I do in a very uncharacteristic, non-traditional way. And I love it. It's fun teaching people. It's fun giving them the power to harness their own creativity and monetize it. So that's probably what I'm going to be focusing on in the future, as well as working with JD under my own name.
Yeah. And JD's, I think, is a really good example of how ghostwriting is evolving at the moment. Because when I first started chatting to JD maybe 4 or 5 years ago, it was a secret that he was working with James Patterson. In fact, I was with him once, and he answered a phone call and said, hi, Jim. And that was actually, you know, because he was very hands-on. But now, you know, I walk into my local bookshop here in Huntingdon in the UK, and there's JD Barker's name in bold print underneath a James Patterson book. And I think that's seems to me a better way of doing things, a more honest and fair way of doing things for both parties.
I think so too, but it really depends on the client. You know, sometimes they want your name on it, sometimes they don't. For me, it was that I built up a successful platform as an author, and now my few ghostwriting clients who were ghostwriting clients, now they're asking if I could put my name on the cover. So I think it's really this, you build your way up to it. It's like building a brand. And at some point, when your brand is attractive, they want your name affiliated with the project.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's talk about ghostwriting then. So you teach it. I mean, I guess the fundamentals of writing are writing, and some will overlap, be useful for people listening to this who are writing for themselves. But how do you structure a course for ghostwriting?
You know, the honest answer is that I woke up one morning when the film crew was coming to my house and I just unloaded everything that was in my brain. I had no syllabus. I had no outline or anything like that. I was afraid it was going to be chaotic and I'd run out of content, but we talked for like 12 hours. And the ghostwriting course, it's all pre-recorded, but I also do one-on-one sessions. It's 6 hours of professionally curated content about everything you really need to know to get started as a ghost. You know, so the basics of interviewing, you know, the power of asking why. That's one of the modules, is the power of why. Asking, you know, what was the most impactful thing that happened in your childhood, the thing that you can never forget? And they tell you something like, well, you know, I fell off my bike, I landed on my head, I got a concussion, then I discovered that there is this underlying health issue that changed my life. You got to say why. Why did it change your life? You can't just let it end there. Oh, okay, cool. Moving on. So blah, blah, blah. What was it like? You got to get into the depth of the story. And so that's one of them, interviewing, contracts, negotiations, finding what I call the mythical white whale. The white whale client is the client of all clients. It's the one that will net you a lot of money, a lot of further opportunities, a lot of recognition. You know, these are celebrities, rock stars, John McAfee's, things like that. And I teach people how to find them, how to locate them, and how to negotiate deals with them. Really, there's so much to ghostwriting people don't really think about. It's not like you just sit down with a recorder and you interview someone and 6 months later you've got a book.
No.
There's so many subtleties to it.
But this interview process, well, that is something that's different for, I mean, I write historical fiction and occasionally I will organize a phone call with somebody who you know, flew military aircraft in the 60s and pick their brains and make some notes.
Yeah.
But what you're doing is absolutely fundamental to the process. And I guess that has to be a kind of structured approach. Do you record the interviews, transcribe them, and how many times do you go back and re-interview? And I've got a supplementary question. Are there tensions that bubble up when you're probing somebody's deepest, darkest life?
Excellent questions all around. So to answer the first one, you interview at length, usually 8 to 10 hours. And
wow.
Each interview hour is 8,000 written words and transcripts. And so you do 10 hours of interviews, you've got 80,000 words, which is the average length of a memoir. A lot of my colleagues, a lot of ghostwriters, it's a sad truth, they take that body of transcripts, they edit it and change some things. They polish it a bit and they call it a book, but that's cheating. That's not writing, that's editing. And it's also editing a conversation, which lacks the fundamental, you know, intrigue of a good story told well. So what I do is I take that body of transcripts and I use that as my content blueprint. That's basically my Bible to refer to. And I start with a blank page and I write the story the way that I feel intuitively it should be written, using that content, again, as my basis. And to answer your next question, are there tensions that arise? Yes, absolutely. Because your job is to sort of find the heart of the story of your client. And in order to do that, you need to sort of mine their deepest, darkest secrets. You need to, you know, psychologically profile them in a way. You need to ask questions that are uncomfortable. I've had people cry during interviews before. I've had people, you know, laughing, falling out of their chair, you know, recounting this incredible experience that they had forgotten about. And to round out that question, it's very cathartic. It's a super cathartic experience for people, you know. But it can be a little unfortunate for the ghost, because if you get somebody who's, you know, a little emotionally unhinged, like John McAfee was, and he threatened to murder me, like, right, you know, it can be dicey. It depends. Don't hire crazy people. Don't work with insane people. That's just rule number one.
Good tip there.
Yeah.
So searching for the story, I mean, that's something. It reminds me of Aaron Sorkin and his masterclass, actually. He talks about someone that comes to him with project ideas, like social network, like the story of Facebook. And he often is dismissive with their first approach because he said, well, that's not the story. You're telling me what happened. That's not the story. And he'll spend a year going around interviewing his personal assistants. And look at the way he wrote the Steve Jobs. I think that was Aaron Sorkin who did the Steve Jobs biopic. I think it was him anyway. Okay. The story turned out to be just the relationship between Jobs, his assistant, and his ex-wife. And that told the story of Apple. And social network became really about Mark Zuckerberg's personality and some share stuff. But he digs away. So I think that's something we can take into our fiction books when you come up with your story. But what is the actual story? What are you telling here? What's the change? And I imagine sometimes, well, not sometimes, I imagine almost every time you sit down with the subject with an autobiography, they've got an idea of what their autobiography is going to be like. But you're searching for the actual story. And that's, again, that's going to be an even bigger clash when you start to draw this together and say, this is what I'm focusing on. That might not be at all what they thought when they started the process.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, usually it's what I call finding the diamonds. Those are the little bunny trails, the little anecdotes that they drop on you like a bomb. And you're like, whoa, wait, back up. You said that you were a drug kingpin when you were in high school. Oh my, let's unpack that. How did that, how did that affect your business practice? Now you're a multimillionaire, super powerful. I would imagine there is some correlation here, And so, I hope that answered the question. I kind of ramble sometimes.
Oh, no, that's good. Well, I don't know how that circle's ever squared though. Do you ever get to the point where your subject is saying, yeah, but I just don't want to go down that track. And you're thinking, but this is, and that happened to me as a journalist, by the way, a lot. Off air before you did, when I used to be a news reporter, people would often say amazing things off air and then say, yeah, but I'm not going to say any of that on air.
That has never happened to me aside from my time with John. John would tell me things and then realize he slipped up and he shouldn't have told me as much as he did and just say, hey, I get final say over everything that's in the book, right? And I say, yes. And he said, okay, well, I don't want that in the book, and right. I would be interviewing him and I wanted to ask about his daughter. So I wasn't allowed to ask about his daughter. That's something that his executive advisor always cautioned me against, but I had to. It's part of the story. How do you be John McAfee without ever talking about your family? Why is that? Why doesn't he talk about his family? I had to ask that question and he just lashed out at me. He did not want to talk about it at all, threatened to leave and stuff and fire me. So
you don't think he was delusional about some of the stuff he talked about, those stuff that slipped out? Do you think it was all true? I mean, that, in the end you walked away because you felt he was a dark character, but do you think he might have been psychotic as well as sociopathic?
I think he was on the psychopathic spectrum, absolutely, and delusional in a way, drug-induced paranoia. He was also paranoid because he knew a lot of dark secrets on powerful, wealthy people, sort of a la Epstein,
Right.
And so that made him very paranoid. He had information, but a lot of what he told me was factual, but also a lot of what he told me was just a pack of lies. So my job was to be discerning enough to, try to understand when he was telling the truth and when he wasn't. And being that I worked with him for so long, I got to know him and we got very close. He used to call me son. And he only did that with a handful of people. I started, becoming more adept at understanding when he was telling the truth or not.
Still, and you're all the time thinking, what shape is this book going to take? And where's the story having to do that? And at some point in that particular case, ending up walking away. But going back to this idea of trying to find the essence of the story, I guess this is something you could do with somebody without their cooperation, right? In fact, I suppose Aaron Sorkin probably didn't have the cooperation of Mark Zuckerberg when he wrote Social Network. And you could choose a character. You could choose Jeffrey Epstein.
Absolutely.
You could choose or Ghislaine Maxwell, someone, and people presumably have done that and write those stories. That sounds to be a similar approach to what you're teaching.
Yep, exactly. And that's sort of the white whale approach right there, is pick a story, pick a person, who's well known in the public domain. And, you know, if you want to write a book about them, you know, go ahead. But depending on who it is, it would certainly benefit you to have a collaboration with them, not Epstein, you know, no. or Maxwell or anybody like that, but someone who's famous and someone who's in the public lexicon, you know.
And have a lawyer, I think, probably.
And absolutely have a lawyer.
Would be
a good one.
So this course, where can people find it, Alex?
Sure, they can find it at ghostwritinguniversity.com. You can sign up for a free mini course. I give, I think it's 7 valuable lessons that I learned. Man, I wish I had this course when I was younger. I wish I knew these things because I had so many pitfalls and time wasters. And like one of the things I talk about is being that, you know, I get 30 requests every week from potential clients, 85 to 90% of which will ultimately lead nowhere. So it's roughly 20% of potential clients I actually speak with, but every email, every message, every project request that I receive, I ask 3 questions right off the bat. 1, what is your ultimate goal for this book? 2, what is your budget? And do you have, or if you don't have one, are you familiar with ghostwriting rates? And 3, when do you want to get started? Based on those 3 answers that they provide me, I know early on whether I would consider working with them or not. And that's just a super simple hack to save you so much time. So you don't do 4 or 5 1-hour phone calls with someone and then broach the subject of budget. And they say, oh, I was going to spend $3,000 on the budget. And you're thinking, wait, I can make more working minimum wage at McDonald's, you know, for 6 months. Yeah. This is crazy. So a lot of hacks in the program.
Well, let's talk about budget. I imagine you're quite sought after now, and it must be a marketplace to an extent, but is there a guideline for what people should be charging?
There is no definitive guideline in the industry. There are some benchmarks. You know, if you're just starting out, you have not written a book, but you're a skilled writer, it wouldn't hurt to be charging $10,000, you know, maybe more, maybe $15,000. Also, it's very different between the markets of the UK and the US. I've noticed that for some reason, ghosts in the UK charge less than the ghosts that I know in the US. I'm not sure why. I mean, we're a very materialistic country. That's probably why.
America. You've got to pay for that wooden lodge you're in.
Exactly. But if you're a published author, or if you have written a book before, it wouldn't hurt to charge $20,000. If you're sought after, maybe you have some bestsellers, you go up, you do $55,000, you know, $75,000, $100,000+. Depending on your efficacy and your track record, if you're successful and you're sought after, you can charge 6 figures easily.
Okay. And that's getting after the more serious end of things. I mean, I guess every major politician and major sports star at some point signs a deal with a big trad company. And they have their in-house staff, do they, or do they call people like you to write those?
It depends. I got a guy over at UTA, United Talent Agency, who's worked with some billionaires and rock stars and stuff. I'm on his list. He's got a short list of ghosts that he reaches out to. That's really something that happens as you get more, you know, sought after in the business. Otherwise, you have agencies like Gotham Ghostwriters and Reedsy, both of which I'm a member of. They get a lot of those kinds of clients, politicians and, you know, celebrities and such. But oftentimes publishing houses will have some ghostwriters that they reach out to on the regular for these big clients.
Does what you teach, Alex, pertain mainly to this type of autobiographical book, or is somebody who's in a stable of romance writers under a pen name, would it be useful for them?
It's useful for all demographics. It's primarily geared toward interviewing. So that would be in the nonfiction and fiction sector, you know, mostly business and memoir, as far as nonfiction goes, but it's fundamental. So teaches you, whether it's fiction, it's romance, or it's business, it teaches you the fundamentals of ghostwriting, you know, how to build up a successful business.
Okay. So going back to your process, you've done your interview, then you have your 80 odd thousand words transcripted. And from those discussions, you, I suppose, have been searching for these diamonds, for these moments that tell the whole story and the shape it's going to take. There must be some traps here, I imagine. One is maybe subjectively trying to force a story onto the situation, thinking, well, that would make a good story, but it's not really the case. The other trap, I suppose, is not really having a coherent structure to it, which I have read some autobiographies where I think could have done with a rewrite at some point to structure this better. But yeah, I mean, talk to us about that process, about once you've got your interviews done.
Once you have the interviews done and you have your content blueprint, all of the transcripts indexed according to your outline, then you need to pour over that content because you're going to do some follow-up interviews. That's usually when you find the diamonds. I mean, right. For me, I usually find the diamonds right during the interview process. So I start unpacking it during the interviews. But starting out, you probably won't pick up on it until you start reading the transcripts. And that's when you get your client on the phone and you do a round two of interviews and you start talking about those big topics. And then it's just the magic, at least for me, the magic of creation. It's just you're sitting down with a blank page, drawing from your transcripts and, you know, visualizing the story in your head like it's a movie, and then writing some baby steps. You know, you want to talk about, well, let's say they're a very powerful businesswoman who's built an empire. You know, she's got a unicorn. And there are not a whole lot of women in tech these days. It's becoming more and more prominent, which is good. She's had a hard life. You know, she grew up with no dad, but her mother was an addict. You know, and she had five siblings. And she essentially had to become a mother for when she's a teenager. And that level of responsibility is directly related to her tenacity in business, you know? So I'm just making that stuff up. I haven't worked with that person, but you got to intuitively then unpack the story page by page, chapter by chapter in a way that you think will resonate the most with the reader. And it's an intuitive process. I talk a lot about it in the course, but it's one of those things you can't really quantify. It's like, it's hard to describe how does one use creativity? How does one find it? It's just kind of there. Mm. And you gotta technically find it in your client, and you gotta mine that creativity for detail. And then you present it, you know, word by word. I'm rambling
again. No. So I think what you're basically saying is you've got to put the work in here. You have to put the graft in. You have to be really familiar with everything that you've gone and go over it again. Because I can imagine it is easy to skip some stages at that point. You've got the 80,000 words, as you say. Some people just reorganize that. And think about, I'm trying to think about, I've read some really great biographies I love. Historical books, and I think very often the technique I like in these books is they start with one scene which doesn't necessarily sit at the beginning of their life, or it might be the middle, it might be the last end of their life, but it's a scene that somehow does, I think what you were talking about there, it captures that one thing. So in the case of that businesswoman, it might be her as a child and an episode that illustrates her tenacity.
Absolutely.
So that's the sort of thing you're talking about.
100%. That's the diamond. You got to open with the diamond. And if it's this incredible story of this entrepreneur who's founded a $1 billion-plus company, you might not just start with the predictable. You might not just start with some boring boardroom meeting where she decides to merge with this other huge company and it becomes massive. That's people don't want that. They want to see the mother, you know, having a drug overdose when she's 13 or 14 years old, and her, you know, her siblings are all, you know, starving because there's nothing in the fridge or in the cabinets to eat. And she's got to rush to the phone and frantically dial 911 to hopefully save her mother's life and save her and her siblings from having to enter, you know, child protective or, you know, services. And so that's what draws you in. That's when you see a different side of your subject and you're like, whoa, there's more to this person. I want to read more. I want to continue. That's what you got to do.
So what's your life look like at the moment? As you say, you get pretty much inundated with requests from people. What sort of person is contacting you now?
Oh, so many. My God. It's you just imagine every demographic of people. And since that film came out, they're reaching out to me, which I feel very humbled by. I can't take on all that work, but I refer a lot of it to my colleagues. But my day-to-day, it's pretty peaceful. I have this beautiful log cabin home on the coast, and I live with my girlfriend and our two dogs, and take the dogs on walks every day when I'm in between breaks from writing. And I interview a lot of people, so that's still going on. I'm still interviewing lots of clients, but yeah, that's it. I wake up, I get coffee, and I write. You know, that's all I do.
So sticking with the ghostwriting other people's lives, that's what you found yourself best at.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Fantastic. Well, you better remind people where they can find the course, Alex, if they want to learn from you.
Sure. They can find the course at ghostwritinguniversity.com. And the book, The Man Who Hacked the World, it's not just the story of John or the story of me. It's really the story of the evolution of a writer and how one can become a writer and become a ghostwriter. So if you're interested in that sort of thing, I would recommend it.
Yeah, fantastic. And that's, I can see it on Amazon. Is it wide? It looks like it is wide, actually.
Yep, all over Barnes & Noble, Turner Bookstore, you know, it's all over now.
Superb. Well, if you're watching on YouTube, one of your dogs did make an appearance in the background, silently, because I think you took off the jingly collar beforehand, which is great. And it looks idyllic. It's been a real pleasure talking to you, Alex. Yeah, I suspect we might even talk again in the future, because it's a big area, and you've had an extraordinary last 12, 24 months or so, I think. Well, in fact, you've had a fairly extraordinary 20-odd years.
That's what people keep telling me. Yeah. That's why I wrote the memoir.
Yeah.
And at some point, someone, an agent out of New York, really wonderful guy, he's my agent now, he said, Alex, I don't care if you work with me or you work with somebody else, but you got to tell this story, man, because it's crazy. And so I decided, you know, it was so cathartic being in that Netflix movie and talking about my time with John. I'll just tell the whole damn story. And I did. And it was like, I tell people it felt like an exorcism. It was a very wild experience, but
yeah,
people like it. I guess I can't judge them.
And it's raised your profile, which has helped in your business as well. So
absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm very grateful.
Alex, thank you so much indeed for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Have a great day.
This is the Self-Publishing Show. There's never been a better time to be a writer.
There you go. Do you know, I wasn't completely across the John McAfee story. I mean, I'd heard it when he talked about it, I remember stuff being in the press at the time. But it's funny to think we all used that McAfee virus software without really knowing there was this, frankly, sociopathic, possibly psychopathic person behind it.
There's a really, really good Netflix documentary about him.
Yes.
That he is he alive or dead? I don't know.
He's dead now.
He's dead. I can speak completely freely without fear of libeling anybody. He was a very interesting, colourful character, to say the least. So on the run for ages from various governments trying to find him. Very interesting.
Well, that was interesting talking to talking to Alex. And you can hear in the interview that Alex is convinced that this wasn't an act. He didn't say this, and I'm not going to put words into Alex's mouth, but my inference is that McAfee has killed and done lots of dark things and has very good reason, had good reason to be on the run. But yeah, interesting.
Well, the reason he went on the run was because his neighbor was killed.
Mm.
And the suspicion, the kind of the allegations were that McAfee shot him.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know. I don't think it was ever proven, but it certainly was a little bit murky.
Very murky. Anyway, very interesting. And Alex is now the new thing in ghostwriting, so people are kicking down the doors to sign him up. He's in a good position. But most of that interview was about the interview process that he carries out, the methodical process of finding the story. And we talked a bit about Aaron Sorkin and others who get stories thrown to them, and then they find what it's actually about, and then they make the film. And that can take a year or so of work. If you're into that sort of thing, ghostwriting. We've talked about ghostwriting a little bit recently, haven't we? And it's still a controversial subject, but that's the arena. I think it's absolutely part and parcel. We accept, don't we, that when David Beckham writes his autobiography, in reality, somebody who can write has written his autobiography, having interviewed him, and that's how that works. I'm sorry.
No way. I don't believe it.
They get The Private Eye, which is always very old. Is a satirical magazine in the UK, and it's very old school and very snobbish about publishing, but it always talks about the sports biographies are read by people who don't read. So they're literally books bought at Christmas for people who will never read them. And there's probably some truth in that, but they sell well at Christmas. Snobbish, isn't it? Okay, right, I've got to go back to my revision. You've got to go back to a house of chaos.
I mean, yes, I have got chaos today. So, daughters at home and all kinds of stuff going on. So,
well, I hope you look at the swans to calm you down a little bit occasionally.
Yeah, they were over there a minute ago. Now they've buggered off. But we've got kingfisher going about quite a lot.
Oh, wow.
Which is quite nice.
Love seeing that.
He kind of lives just down there. I'm pointing out the window. But herons, cormorants today. It's all very nice.
Such a treat seeing a kingfisher.
Yeah.
Okay. Great. Thank you very much, Mark. Thank you to the team. And thank you to Alex, our interviewee, for today. All that remains for me to say is goodbye from him.
And a goodbye from me. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Get show notes, the podcast archive, and free resources to boost your writing career at selfpublishingshow.com. Join our thriving Facebook group at selfpublishingshow.com/Facebook. Support the show at patreon.com/selfpublishingshow. And join us next week for more help and inspiration so that you can make your mark as a successful indie author. Publishing is changing, so get your words into the world and join the revolution with the Self-Publishing Show.